WNYC in New York. This is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the General Accounting Office reopened its investigation into a series of ads produced by the Department of Health and Human Services. The ads at issue purport to inform seniors about the new Medicare law. Democrats last month charged that the TV spots were misleading and a misuse of taxpayer money, offering more advocacy than education, as Senator Edward Kennedy told us.
Clearly, it's improper and clearly it's outrageous to use Medicare beneficiaries' money for campaign sloganing, and that's what this is all about.
But the GAO determined that though it, quote, noted several worthy omissions in HHS's materials, including the cost of some services to seniors, the ads were still legal. Now the spotlight has moved from the ads to White House-sponsored video news releases, or VNRs. In a moment, you'll hear more about those dirty little secrets of journalism. But for now, suffice it to say that such spots look like news and sound like news, but they are not news.
Medicare officials emphasize that no one will be forced to sign up for any of the new benefits.
It's completely voluntary. Seniors will be able to partake of the new Medicare system or the old Medicare system.
The new law, say officials, simply offers people with Medicare ways to make their health coverage more affordable. In Washington, I'm Karen Ryan reporting.
Karen Ryan describes herself as a PR professional, and she was reading from a script approved by HHS. It may have been education, as the government claims, or it may have been propaganda, as many Democrats contend, but it wasn't journalism. Still, viewers of the roughly 40 stations that ran the spot can be forgiven for thinking it was. Several TV news directors thought so, too, among them Lynn Brooks, who also anchors the news at KVUA in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Last month, she pulled and broadcast the Medicare VNR from the package of stories they get daily from CNN News Source.
Basically, you look at the news source feed just like you would look down the Associated Press wire. You'll get a subject line that may say Medicare, or it'll say sports highlights. It's just a big, long listing of all the stories that come down from CNN that day. If you're a producer and you're looking at the script of that story, there's nothing really that tells you that, you know, this is a video news release. It just looks like a reporter package.
She says she receives VNRs every day from dozens of companies hawking their wares, and regarding them as basically video press releases, she throws them in the trash. Obviously not so with the daily news feed.
We just take them at face value, assuming that the folks on the other end have done their legwork to make sure that it's balanced and that it's legitimate. So when we get a video news release from our friends over at CNN, it just catches you off guard. It's unfortunate.
These materials are clearly marked as VNRs in three highly visible places.
CNN spokesman Matt Furman can't understand the confusion.
You cannot read this script without noticing that what you're reading is a video news release.
Meanwhile, HHS says such ads and VNRs have been used by several administrations, Democratic and Republican. In the last several years, they've addressed everything from Head Start to women's soccer to body sores. Here's a clip from a 1999 Clinton-era VNR about Medicare, specifically a reform bill that stressed preventative care.
Studies show that preventive medicine can help reduce costly hospital bills and surgeries and allow seniors to enjoy longer, healthier lives. Lavelle Brigham reporting.
But just because it's a bipartisan practice doesn't mean it's not mischief, especially in an election year when arguments over Medicare continue to dominate the headlines. On Thursday, 20 journalism organizations representing more than 25,000 journalists called on all news organizations to preserve their independence by avoiding the use of such VNRs. Andrew Holtz, president of the Association of Healthcare Journalists, also takes the government to task.
Why should a public agency produce something that could be misused? What's the purpose of producing a finished, edited news report? And I hold public servants to a higher standard than I would a private business. I expect them to look out for what's in the larger public interest and refrain from doing things in a PR sense that possibly would mislead or confuse the public.
But ultimately, it's up to news organizations to not confuse the public, and usually they know very well when they've received a VNR as opposed to real news, and they still use them. Last year, Garfield laid bare the awful truth about the evening news.
Sure, it's packed with vitamin C, but orange juice has plenty more to offer. It can help protect your heart by raising your good cholesterol. And when it's fortified, it's a great source of calcium for non-milk drinkers. And that's not all.
It's also rich in potassium, which reduces our risk for high blood pressure and for stroke.
That was a story about the health miracle of orange juice on WWLP-TV, Springfield, Massachusetts. But it wasn't a story discovered, written, and produced by WWLP. It was a VNR, a video news release, prepared by the Ketchum PR agency on behalf of its client, in this case, PepsiCo's Tropicana. Each year, thousands of such VNRs are distributed by corporations, government agencies, nonprofit organizations, and even members of Congress who have discovered it's easier to manage the news when you actually produce it yourself. Thus, the ever-growing deluge of expensively produced news-like video reports, crafted often by ex-journalists, to look and sound like actual telejournalism.
It is not news. It is fake news.
John Stauber is executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy and author of Toxic Sludge is Good for You, a scathing lefty broadside against the public relations industry. He believes the use of VNRs amounts to systematic deception of viewers, both by the hidden interested parties behind them and by news organizations with impure motives themselves.
So if I'm a TV news director and I can fill most of the so-called 7 or 8 minute news hole on a local TV news program with provided footage that I get for free, I can save tens of thousands of dollars or more.
News directors don't like to talk about VNRs. The few who returned our calls said they seldom use the free material. But according to Nielsen Media Research, by 1994, 100% of TV stations were using them, and 80% were doing so at least several times a month. And today's digital watermarking of the footage proves nothing has changed. Larry Moskowitz is the founder and president of MediaLink, one of the world's largest producers and distributors of VNRs.
We determined prima facie and scientifically and electronically that every television station in America with a newscast has used and probably uses regularly this material from corporations and organizations that we provide as VNRs or B-roll or other terminology we may use.
Not all VNRs run whole. Most often they are mined for a clip of background footage here, an interview fragment there. But producers estimate that as many as 1 in 3 appear uncut, unedited, and unexamined for balance or even basic accuracy. And why? Because they are there, tempting budget-battered news directors, and because they are free.
VNRs are enabling devices.
Former CBS correspondent Deborah Potter is director of the News Lab, the Washington, D.C. nonprofit dedicated to quality local television.
They allow newsrooms to do less of their own work without fear of running out of material before the end of the hour. It's a concern, and it ought to be a concern, frankly, for viewers if much of the material that they're starting to get on the news isn't news.
As long as there has been a press, there has been a symbiotic relationship between journalism and PR, and not necessarily an insidious one. Publicists and politicians looking to promote their agendas can serve those interests and the media's as well by calling attention to news or even fluff of interest to the public. It then becomes the media's job to establish the broader context and to separate the newsworthy wheat from the gratuitously promotional chaff, and to be clear about the source of PR-furnished material. For instance, the Tropicana excerpt you heard at the top of this piece we found in a documentary based on John Stauber's book, Deborah Potter.
I feel very strongly that if stations are going to use VNR material, they need to tell where it came from. It makes a difference if the whaling video you're using came from Greenpeace or from the Coalition to Support Whaling.
Barbara Cochran, president of the Radio and Television News Directors Association, says she believes most stations and networks do routinely identify the source of outside video, as per the ethical guidelines of her organization. But those within the VNR industry roll their eyes at that assertion. Doug Simon of VNR producer D.S. Simon Productions says disclosure is the exception, not the rule.
from what we see, there's a very small percentage, perhaps less than 5%, that actually is identified what the source of the video is.
That makes him uneasy, but VNR producers can't do such disclosure themselves. Each station uses a different on-screen typeface to identify video, so the onus is on those airing the material. And dependent as they are on the illusion of a far-flung news-gathering operation with tentacles throughout the community and beyond, there's little motivation to do so.
Can I say that local television stations have been lax? Yeah.
MediaLink's Moskowitz acknowledges that stations are less than scrupulous about identifying the source of the footage he supplies. He does not believe, however, that the sin is particularly grave, at least compared to other forms of journalism.
There is more unexpurgated, unedited, and unredacted press information that shows up in the average daily newspaper in America, and certainly in the average weekly newspaper, probably by a 5-to-1 factor over the PR material that shows up in television. So you might be going after the wrong goat here.
The two wrongs make a right argument isn't the only one in favor of the video news release. Candace White, marketing professor at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville and co-author of a 2001 study about VNRs, says the same self-interest that encourages news directors to use VNRs dictates that the material is used responsibly.
See, I trust news producers to be able to weed out true news value. I give them credit for being able to recognize blatant sales pitches. Our study found that the corporate videos were used the least, and the ones about health and safety were used the most.
But it's not necessarily the blatant sales pitches that are so dangerous. It is the subtle sales pitches, and the implication of independent journalistic approval conferred on a company or organization and its point of view, which is why her study's co-author, journalism professor Mark Harmon, sees VNRs as, quote, insidious devices by corporate America to control the American agenda. Nor is the problem restricted to the local news. Not only do major networks use VNR footage, at least one, CBS, has a division which produces and distributes them. This gets back to the disdain and fear voiced by author and consumer advocate John Stauber.
All public relations is not sinister or evil or bad. But I think the important thing to understand is that, indeed, all public relations is propaganda.
So whether it's images of a NASA spacewalk or a self-congratulatory soundbite from your congressman or swell health news about delicious calcium-fortified Tropicana orange juice, the message for TV news consumption is as ever. Let the viewer beware.
Coming up, assessing the coverage of the war from Baghdad to D.C.,
this is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A year ago this week, bombs began falling over Baghdad. A year ago, we were told repeatedly that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, that Saddam Hussein had ties to Al-Qaeda, and that there was definitive proof to back those charges up. But as Saddam's regime vaporized, so did much of the so-called evidence that propelled us to war. We've known for a while that much of the faulty intelligence came from defectors who were members of the Iraqi National Congress. What we haven't known until this week was how few in number those defectors were, only 6, and how widely they spread that bad information. We know now because the Knight Ridder newspapers have obtained a letter that was sent in June of 2002 to the Senate Appropriations Committee. It came from the Iraqi National Congress's Information Collection Program, funded by the United States. That letter provided a list of 108 news reports that cited the defectors' information. Jonathan Landay is a national correspondent for Knight Ridder. As he describes it, it's a pretty impressive list.
According to the letter, they included the New York Times, the Washington Post, Vanity Fair, the Atlantic Monthly, the Times of London, the Sunday Times of London, several newspapers in Australia, and several Knight Ridder papers. These stories were either originally reported or picked up and circulated by the Associated Press and other news organizations, including Agence France-Presse, so that there was sort of this multiplying effect going on. These stories involved, to a large extent, interviews with the same defectors from Iraq produced by the INC for journalists. And when you read what these defectors said, a number of themes jump out at you. The first being that Saddam had been collaborating for years with Osama bin Laden and was complicit in the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, that Iraq had mobile warfare facilities disguised as yogurt and milk trucks and had biological or illicit weapons production and storage facilities underneath Baghdad's largest hospital, in fake water wells and under several of Saddam's palaces. They go on. Several of these defectors had been interviewed by CIA and FBI officers and discarded as being unreliable or exaggerators or having been coached.
Okay, so after the first Gulf War and the revelations after it that the Kingdom of Kuwait had actually hired a public relations firm to present false testimony in Congress to generate anger at the Iraqis, after the press learned its lesson from that, how could a reflexively skeptical institution like the American media so get suckered by such a small number of defectors who so clearly had an axe to grind in this?
I can speculate on several reasons. One, that everybody, the government, outside experts, Congress, the general public, other governments, believed sincerely that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. And so these guys seem to be confirming what most people already took to be gospel. Now, let's also remember that this began taking place in the immediate weeks after the September 11th attacks. And there may have been journalists who were leaning so far forward on this terrorism issue that these things seemed to be a natural mesh. You know, just to be absolutely truthful, until my colleagues and I started reporting, I also believed that Saddam Hussein had illicit weapons. The other thing I have to say is that many of these stories do note that the information they contained could not be independently verified.
What can we learn from the smoking gun letter? And do you think the press will be chastened from this point forward?
One of the things that I think is apparent is that as each journalist was introduced to these defectors, what I don't know that they did was simply get on the internet and go to Google and plug in the names and the information they were being given. As these defectors were sort of passed down this journalistic conveyor belt, if you will, their stories started taking on differences and in some cases became quite fantastic and sensational. And that really raised some red flags with me. So it raises the whole question of sourcing and the propensity, perhaps, of some journalists to go with sources without collaborating the information they're being told from independent sources.
Now, there's an interesting footnote to all of this, and that is that the same group of people who were doing such a lousy job furnishing accurate information in the build-up to the war have been quite useful to the Pentagon and to intelligence services since the U.S. occupied Baghdad.
According to senior officials that I've spoken to, the information collection program being run by the Iraqi National Congress may have, in fact, saved American lives since the fall of Baghdad, in that the INC has produced very valuable information identifying members of the anti-U.S. insurgency in Iraq and allowing their arrests by the military.
Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Jonathan Landay is a national correspondent for the Knight Ridder newspapers. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
The media were a strong and steady presence in the war against Saddam, partly because of a shift in military strategy. The Pentagon had been dissatisfied with the coverage of the recent war in Afghanistan because reporters didn't cover its successes. They didn't cover it because they weren't there. After Vietnam, it was Pentagon policy to keep reporters away from the battlefield. So with the Iraq War came an about-face. Some 800 reporters were stationed with military units in an innovative program called Embedding.
Embedded reporters had their own rules of engagement. They were to stay with their units. They couldn't move from unit to unit or visit civilian areas without losing their place. Under military protection, they had access only to information commanding officers were willing to provide. This led to the charge that the so-called embeds saw the war through a soda straw, limited to covering the heroism of their units. But those stories exerted a mesmerizing power on cable TV, and the Pentagon called the embed experiment a great success.
Throughout the war, we spoke to NPR's John Burnett, who did move eventually from one unit to another and then abandoned his spot altogether to report on where the bombs had landed, places that his units did not go. This was from our first conversation on the eve of war.
I'm actually standing on the front porch of the Hilton Hotel in Kuwait City, which overlooks the Persian Gulf. And we're sitting here waiting to embed with the troops, watching the waves and waiting for our call.
When I look back on being an embedded reporter, I think about the story that was so important in the moment. But my wife is a historian, and I guess that's influenced the way I look at some of these things. And I see that what historians are going to write about is the occupation, is the war for the peace, which is happening right now. The war that we covered, that the embedded reporters covered, was a foregone conclusion. And it's almost a footnote to what is really going to matter in sort of the grand scheme of things.
And yet at the time, it was so consuming. In fact, we have a clip here about your worrying about the effect the close quarters with the troops would have on your critical reporting skills.
When we live in the same conditions that these thousands and thousands of soldiers do, which is sandstorms, sleeping on the floors of tents, the fine dust, the consistency of talcum powder everywhere. This is what the Marines like to call an austere environment. I would say that you may start having journalists who left the United States as doves turning into, if not hawks, at least blue jays.
Did you turn into a blue jay?
The experience of being with a Marine unit coming under fire from enemy forces can really make neutrality difficult in this. I think you and I had talked about the sense of, you know, did I grasp any of the opposition to the war when I was traveling and living with the troops? Mm-hmm. And I think we lost all trace of that. It's hard not to sympathize with the troops that you're living with in that environment.
Here's one from a week later, and that's exactly what we heard in your voice.
A Marine captain and a colonel took three journalists in, and so we went in surrounded by military, and we had to have our chemical suits at our sides. We had to have our bulletproof vests and our Kevlar helmets and all this stuff, and here's all the other unilateralist journalists all running around in T-shirts and jeans and kind of looking at us curiously, and it reminded me of being with my parents on vacation and how you sort of look at all the other kids on the beach and sometimes wish you were running wild like them, but it was kind of secure and nice to be with your parents, too.
I spoke to some media critics during the war, and I remember one of them said, whoever thought up the embed program deserves three extra stars for their epaulette because it couldn't have been planned better to co-opt the reporting experience. Would you agree?
Well, it was a trade-off from the beginning, and a year later, it still looks that way to me. I mean, keep in mind that embedding is a goofy name for an arrangement that has existed going back decades with war correspondents and the military. Now it just rhymes with in bed with, which is unfortunate because that's the impression that it gave a lot of people, including Tim Robbins, who has a new play called Embedded, which makes the reporters seem like duped, complicit buffoons. I think it served both sides. The military got a lot of dashing press with, you know, some very courageous troops fighting against the Saddam resistance, and reporters got a good story. It's always a trade-off, and it was in this war, too.
This is a difficult question, I think, for a lot of people who see it from far, far away. We see our troops in action. We see how well-trained they are. But as you said yourself, we hardly ever got to see where the bombs landed. And that was because the cable news operations and a lot of the reporting in general was focused on this embedded experience. It seems that the Pentagon hijacked the coverage of the war by creating this wide-open opportunity that I guess was an offer we couldn't refuse.
Well, I mean, I've also talked to a lot of other embedded reporters in the last year, and it really depended on what unit you were with and where your soda straw was pointed. when you and I signed off early last summer, I was very ambivalent about the embedding process because I think there needs to be more independent movement on the battlefield so that someone can find out if a shell shot downrange hit its target and what the result was and be able to go into the villages through which the invasion force is passing and find out what people are saying. We were very limited in our ability to do that.
You talked about Tim Robbins' play here in New York. That presents the American reporters there as complete dupes. Is that frustrating?
Well, it is, because the invasion of Iraq is being seen in light of what we know now and all of the problems with the premise of this war all over the front pages and in the presidential campaigns. And so I think people are feeling they were duped by the reporting that led up to the fall of Baghdad. And this play that's out, it's unfair to the journalists who worked very hard and risked their lives to try to get the story right. That's what we knew at the time. That's what we saw through our periscopes. Whether history judges it right or wrong, you can only report what you know.
John, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure, Brooke.
NPR's John Burnett served as an embedded reporter during last year's Iraq invasion with the 1st Marine Division.
Throughout Russia's election season, the opposition complained that the government-controlled media were stifling real debate. And this week, Vladimir Putin, surprising no one, won 70% of the vote and a second term as president. Among other promises in his victory speech, Putin declared that he would do everything to, quote, ensure the freedom of mass media. But to Fred Weir, who covers Russia for the Christian Science Monitor, that declaration rang a little hollow.
It would have been an awful lot more convincing had he made that commitment before the campaign began, because this particular election campaign was marked by the state using its media resources against the opposition to make sure that Putin won.
We have seen the consolidation of media under state control, or at least influence, criminal prosecution of a couple of media magnates, at least one very repressive media law about how elections can be covered. Is there any sense that the media are acquiescing to his form of despotism?
Well, the three television networks are completely on side. All of them run newscasts that resemble Soviet-era newscasts. Any little tiny news item involving the president, often long and banal, conversations with visiting foreign dignitaries are played verbatim.
What about the print press?
The picture is more diverse there. Newspapers have visibly muted the kind of debate that they used to reflect. But there are still some fairly combative newspapers. There are still a couple of newspapers owned by Boris Berezovsky, the exiled oligarch, and they do publish critical material. Very few people on the scale of Russia actually read these newspapers, but they are there. And the internet is also wide open.
Now that the election is over, is there any reason to think that he will loosen the reins on press coverage?
I took his election night remarks as an admission on his part that the campaign had really shown, because it was almost farcical, had really shown up the weaknesses of this kind of authoritarian system, and that he himself would like to change it. But it's not that easy in a bureaucratic state that has the history of this country, that once you set these things in motion, a few declarations won't reverse the flow of events.
Can we assume that the declaration was more for foreign consumption than for domestic?
I think so. At home, he doesn't really face any criticism, and there are two reasons for that. One reason is the media is really under control, but also Russians, really, all public opinion polls do confirm this. They care about stability and order, and they hope their lives will become a bit more prosperous, and they are willing to accept an authoritarian governance in exchange for that.
clearly Vladimir Putin imagines himself to be some sort of enlightened despot. And maybe he is one. Is there any argument to suggest that the temporary repression of democratic voices while he's just attempting to get some semblance of organization in this large and unwieldy bureaucracy and to get the big crooks in jail, any reason to think that this is to the ultimate good of Russia?
So many people say he's really a liberal at heart. And Putin himself, if you read his speeches closely, seems to be saying, we first of all have to get things in hand before we can do anything. The problem, if it's just my opinion, is that this is the old poison of Russian history. There have been so many authoritarian attempts to modernize this country, and some of them have been quite successful in their own right. I mean, Soviet communism was an extended attempt to use the power of the state to build a strong superpower, and it worked for a long time, but it creates so many really bad byproducts, and absolute power itself becomes corrupt. This is an old lesson in Russian history, and I'm afraid that Russians are going to rediscover it.
All right, Fred. Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Fred Weir covers Russia for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us from his dacha outside of Moscow.
Coming up, why drug reform groups charge that there's no free speech on city buses, and Dawn of the Dead, Redux.
Redux, rerun. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. On the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The government's huge 2004 spending bill includes $145 million for war on drugs advertising, focusing specifically on marijuana. Those ads appear all over the Washington, D.C. metro system and public transport systems around the country. But there are two sides to every story, including this one, and reform groups have countered with ads that charge the war on marijuana, anyway, is a waste of time and money. Now those groups are also charging the government with censorship because an amendment in the spending bill says that funding will be denied to any transit authority that accepts ads criticizing the drug war. The American Civil Liberties Union has teamed up with marijuana reform groups to sue the government and the D.C. metro system for censorship. Graham Boyd is director of the ACLU's Drug Policy Litigation Project, and he joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what precisely does the amendment say?
What it says is that recipients of federal funds for transit systems, so not just the Washington subways and buses, but similar systems around the country, they can run ads on anything they want to except ads that call for a change in drug laws. Those ads can't be run or else that metro system will lose literally millions, perhaps even billions of dollars in federal aid.
So they're free to accept ads that counter the government's widely advertised stance on marijuana. But if they do accept the ads, they must also accept the consequences that their funding could be yanked, right?
Well, I suppose you could put it that way. But I mean, honestly, there's no choice involved in it at all. The transit system would have to fold, would have to go out of business without the federal subsidies. It's worth noting, though, that these are paid advertisements. We are willing and able to support the metro system in Washington with paid advertisements. But the government says it doesn't like our message, and so it prefers censorship.
Describe as clearly as you can the ad that you say the government doesn't want us to see.
The ad the government has censored here is a picture of a crowd of people, average Americans, people of different ages and races, and imposed over the crowd are bars, like a prison cell. It says marijuana laws waste billions of taxpayer dollars to lock up nonviolent Americans. That's the headline. And then in the small text, it explains that one out of three adult Americans have used marijuana or subject to being locked up, and that hundreds of thousands of people are locked up every year losing their ability to go to college, their college loans, their jobs, their ability to get public benefits of all sorts, and calling overall for a reassessment of a system that is not working. It's not reducing marijuana use. It's not increasing the public health, but it's wasting money and destroying people's lives.
When the Republican from Oklahoma, Representative Ernest Istook, offered this amendment to the spending bill, what was his justification?
His justification was that he did not want to see public spaces being used to provide information that would promote, and these are his words, promote the legalization or medical use of any substance that's listed as a controlled substance, in other words, marijuana and other such drugs. To my mind, if the government is so concerned about its policy being questioned by the public that it has to essentially hide information from the public, I think that's a real sign that that policy is in trouble.
So what happens next then?
Well, we're in court now. We filed a case in federal court charging that this congressional law violates the First Amendment. I don't think it's legally a difficult case. It's hard to imagine a clearer violation of the First Amendment than having the government speak in favor of one political position but then censoring the other point of view. We expect a ruling from the court probably in May or shortly thereafter of this year, and that would allow our advertisements to go forward. I think the open question is what happens next with other transit authorities. Will they then agree to run the ads? Will Congress change the law? Will we need to bring suits in other places? And I don't know the answer to that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Graham Boyd, director of the ACLU's Drug Policy Litigation Project, joined me from the Yale Media Center. Congressman Ernest Istook penned the amendment that inspired the lawsuit. He chairs the Appropriations Subcommittee on Transportation that handles billions of dollars in public transportation funding. His subcommittee is also responsible for funding the Office of the National Drug Control Policy, and he stands by his law.
We did not think that we ought to be sending a mixed message, paying taxpayers money for buses that would be displaying ads advocating legalization of marijuana at the same time as we were spending a lot of taxpayers' money to try to tell people don't use the stuff.
Okay. Now, a coalition of drug policy reform groups have created some ads that aren't advocating the legalization of marijuana per se, but are basically questioning the efficacy of the war on drugs. And the ACLU is challenging your amendment in a recent lawsuit which names the Secretary of Transportation, Norman Mineta, and the Washington, D.C. MTA, which rejected its ads. They charge that your amendment is a kind of censorship, even a sort of blackmail. Take these ads and lose the funding.
Isn't it silly how quickly people resort to using a term such as censorship when you're talking about how you use taxpayers' property? And frankly, the difficulty arose because the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority was giving them free space, free taxpayers' money. And I realize now they say, well, maybe we're willing to pay for it, but that's what they did to set up the lawsuit. What they're really after is they want the free ad space. And remember the parallels of this. Look at what we've done with cigarette advertising. Cigarette advertising has been banned from the public airwaves over 30 years now? I think it was 1971. And, it was done for public health reasons, and certainly marijuana has significant impact on public health.
They aren't advocating the legalization of marijuana. They're questioning the efficacy of the war on drugs. Does this somehow send a mixed message, or simply that the government needs to reevaluate how it's conducting that war?
Really, this group's goal is the legalization of marijuana. Now, a particular ad, they may craft it a little bit differently, but it's part of the overall ad campaign. The ones that appeared on the buses earlier had a picture of a young couple. If I recall correctly, I think they were in swimming suits to boot. And it said, "Want better sex? Legalize and tax marijuana." Now, that is the message of this group. Whether they want to do some subset of that message in one ad and different parts of the other, their goal is to legalize the use of marijuana.
All right, but would you remove your objections if they limited their advertising to criticizing the war on drugs and were willing to pay for it?
Well, actually, they can use different means of advertising if they want to. They don't have to use a public property. They do not have to use a bus that in Washington, D.C. is used not only for general public's transportation, but is also used as a school bus. If these people want to do an ad campaign at their own expense, for goodness sakes, they should be out there raising money and buying ads on other media, and there's plenty of media that are available to
right.
them.
Right.
But they should not be asking to use public subsidized property, which is what this issue is all about.
We had an earlier conversation with Graham Boyd of the ACLU, and he portrayed your amendment as, and I'll quote, powerful evidence that the war on drugs is in trouble and that you and others are in effect trying to hide their viewpoint from the public view.
That's silly. If they want to put their message out, go out and buy a billboard.
Congressman Ernest Istook is a Republican from Oklahoma.
A headline this week from Canada's National Post: will zombies slay Christ in box office battle? We'll know any day now, because the much-anticipated remake of George Romero's Dawn of the Dead opened Friday. Why anticipated? Because the original Dawn was the sequel to Night of the Living Dead, and though more than 25 years old, the sagas of the flesh-eating resurrected still grip audiences, despite a vast improvement in special effects. In fact, zombie stories have entranced us since the dawn of the movie business. OTM senior producer Arun Rath pondered the social commentary inherent in the zombie genre, starting with the first, Dawn of the Dead.
In the most celebrated scene, hundreds of zombies stumble, blank-eyed, through a suburban shopping mall. Mindless consumerism had the country eating itself.
What are they doing? Why do they come here?
Some kind of instinct, memory, what they used to do. This was an important place in their lives.
But zombie movies have had a rich subtext from the very first, White Zombie, released in 1932.
At this time, we were engaged in the occupation of the island of Haiti, which had been a former slave colony of France. Zombies originally are a folkloric creature imported from West Africa.
Peter Dendel is a professor of English at Pennsylvania State University, specializing in folklore and medieval studies. And he's the author of the Zombie Movie Encyclopedia.
I think it's with some irony, then, that the American entertainment industry picks up this icon in the 1930s, because in these movies, in these early movies, it is a sort of white voodoo master or mad scientist who raises the zombies for his own menial ends, to take over the world or just to run his factory or whatever.
The black Haitian zombies in the film literally slave away in a sugar mill run by voodoo master Murder Legendre, played to the hypnotic hilt by a still-vital Bela Lugosi.
They work faithfully. They are not worried about long hours. You could make good use of men like mine on your plantation, no?
The white zombie of the title is Madeline, an American woman who has come to Haiti with her fiancé to be married at the estate of Beaumont, a man they just met. Beaumont falls in love with Madeline and convinces Legendre to turn her into a zombie so she'll submit to him. Yes, along with an overwrought racial dynamic, there's a huge serving of gender politics.
You've got Bela Lugosi being in possession of a woman's body, for instance, of a living or half-living, moving body, going through the motions of living, getting up in the morning, coming down to the table, but with no glimmer in her eye, with no sense of passion or responsiveness. You've got them being in total control of them, and you've got to scratch your head and wonder, what are they doing when the camera's off?
The black zombie slaves and controlled woman themes appeared throughout early zombie films like I Walked with a Zombie, Voodoo Man, and the aptly named Woman Eater. Racial and sexual anxieties have a timeless appeal, but by the 1950s, the American subconscious had bigger fish to fry.
Since the first revelation of the atom bomb at Hiroshima in 1945, the United States, England, and Russia have been experimenting with more and more increasingly deadly weapons.
In 1959's sneakily subversive Invisible Invaders, nuclear tests convince aliens that Earth is finally worth conquering. They do this by taking possession of human corpses and making them attack the living. mankind's savior, an anti-nuke peacenik scientist.
You say we should call an immediate end to nuclear experimentation, but you know that's impossible.
Then limit it to experiments for peace.
Dr. Penner, we've been over all this before.
The zombies of Invisible Invaders seem almost entirely middle-aged white men in suits and ties.
What is a zombie but a conformist? What is a zombie but someone who has to go through the motions, maybe with some tiny instinctual primal awareness underneath it all, that he's not fully experiencing what it means to be an individual, to be human?
But lest you think that the zombie is a creature of the left, film critic David Edelstein points out the depersonalized zombie was also a fine metaphor for what was creepy about communism.
I mean, any kind of collective delusion, communism as well. I mean, you can look at Don Siegel's Invasion of the Body Snatchers and the Phil Kaufman remake as zombie movies. These are movies in which people have their individuality deadened and they become part of the collective.
The reanimated corpses may have represented soulless Eisenhower conformists, or maybe they were soulless communists. But one thing seems clear. The real enemy was us. Whether it's zombies and invisible invaders or pod people from Invasion of the Body Snatchers, characters are repeatedly confronted with friends and family who now see them as prey. And in 1968, just when it must have seemed like America really was turning on itself, in a year of assassinations, violent protests, and race riots, George Romero came out with Night of the Living Dead. David Edelstein says the film is a powerful metaphor for the meltdown of the American family.
The American family imploding from within. It's no accident that brothers turn incestuously on sisters. And that little daughters kill their own mommies.
In the film, a group of survivors barricade themselves against a zombie onslaught in an abandoned farmhouse. Our protagonist is Ben, the only black man in the bunch. He's also the only one who's not petty, rendered stupid by fear, or just plain stupid to begin with. Because of his level-headedness, Ben is the only one to survive the night. But the next morning, he's shot by a band of roving rednecks deputized to exterminate the zombie menace.
All right, Vince, hit him in the head, right between the eyes. Good shot. Okay, he's dead. Let's go get him. That's another one for the fire.
Peter Dendel.
A lot of the images in Night of the Living Dead respond specifically to some of these social tensions. The reliance on authority sort of falling apart. The police force is a veritable sort of militia of rednecks.
Get those dogs back off of those things!
In Romero's story, every person who died became a zombie, rising again to feed on the flesh of the living. The decades after Night of the Living Dead saw an explosion of movies in this vein, and Romero-esque zombies appeared in hundreds of features, even spawning cottage industries in Italy and Spain. And since 1968, Romero's zombie children have taken off in countless symbolic directions.
Zombies are blanks. You can project anything you want on them.
David Edelstein.
You can make them Southern KKK hicks, and they can become mindless reactionaries, or you can give them vests and peace signs, and they become mindless counterculture drug casualties. You can give them plague, and then they become carriers of sexual diseases. Romero's innovation in Night of the Living Dead was to make them cannibals or vampires, to make them actual carriers of plague, and this is something that's followed through on in 28 Days Later.
28 Days Later features a zombie plague created by the release of a deadly or undeadly virus. As in most of the post-Romero films, the main characters tend to meet their end not because of the zombies, but because they lose their head. Or their humanity.
Easy, Tiger. You know what I got picking a fight with me, son?
Sergeant Farrell! Mitchell, first action on.
We secured a perimeter, sir.
Then get to it.
The true horror, it turns out, isn't the infected, but the people who put their own welfare over the rights of others. It's not the flesh-gouging zombie that we have to worry about in those movies. It's the soul-gouging zombie within.
When 28 Days Later came out last summer, critics raved about its broader themes, which included sexism and man's tendency to fascism and fear of a self-induced apocalypse. It was dubbed the Thinking Man's Zombie Movie, a distinction only true if you haven't been paying attention for the past 70 years. For On the Media, I'm Arun Roth.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Rob Christensen our engineer. We had help from Derek John. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.